Today's Teisho will be case 10 in the Haikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Bokushu's Empty-Headed Fool. Engo's Introduction. Yes is yes, no is no. In the Dharma battle, each stands on his own ground. Therefore, it is said, when one's activity is upward, even Shakyamuni, Maitreya, Manjushri, Samantabhadra, the thousand holy ones and teachers of the whole world become spiritless and silent. When one's activity is downward, even maggots, gnats, and all creatures become brilliantly illuminating and as independent as 10,000 mile cliffs. However, how is it when one's activity is neither upward nor downward? If there is any rule, rely on the rule. If there is no rule, follow a precedent. See the following. Main subject. Bokushu asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk gave a katsu shout. Bokushu said, "This old monk is shouted down by you." The monk shouted again. Bokushu said, "What about after the third and fourth shouts?" The monk stayed silent. Bokushu hit the monk and said, "You empty-headed fool." Secho's verse, two shouts, three shouts. The knowing one knows well. If going hell-bent, both are blind. Who is blind? Fetch him. Expose him to the world. This is, I think, this is day three of the session. That's right, isn't it? Day three. It's a little hard for me to keep track of the time. In fact, just now, after the sit, I got up and I raced into the kitchen and I started taking off my robes and Jim came in. And I said, "Quick, wash the woks. We've got to get them ready. I've got to make the beans." And he was very nice. He didn't say, "You idiot," you know. I kept going. I was, you know, and I said, "Well, Ilusha comes in, we've got to scrub those walks." And finally, he very politely said, "But don't we have a tay show?" And I said, "Oh, yeah." That's right. And he was so polite and kind about it. I was very grateful. And I didn't feel like an idiot at all. And but it's hard to believe, personally, it's hard to believe that it's day three already. It's day three. Oh my gosh. I mean, it just seems like everybody just arrived. You know, it just seems like, I've been doing the sesshin for 30 years, and I have pretty much done at least four every year for 30 years, and in some years I did seven or eight. So I've done a lot of sesshin, and if you just hang in there long enough, you really will have a different perspective on all this. You know, when I first started practicing, I went to my first sesshin because I had read some books on Zen, and I had run into Genki Roshi, and I had been sitting with his group only for about a month, maybe a month or two. And this, I've told this story before, you'll have to forgive me, but it's just, there was this beautiful Japanese American woman who was the Jikijutsu. She was sort of like in charge of the Zendo at the Seattle Zen Center. And her name was Wendy Nakao. And she is now the head of the Los Angeles Zen Center, major Zen Center. But at that time she was living in Seattle and was studying with Genki Roshi. And so I had just been sitting with that group for maybe a month or two. And Wendy came up to me and she said, you know, she was very attractive and charming. And she looked at me with these beautiful eyes and she said, "Are you going to Sesshin?" And I really didn't know what Sesshin was, but I said, "Yes, sure." And so, you know, then I realized, oh, okay, got it, you know. So why not? retreat, you know. And I can remember after the first Sesshin, just, if I'm remembering properly, I think I was teaching my first class that semester. And I went to write something. After the Sesshin, I came back and I started teaching. And then I remember I went to the board to write something. And my mind just went totally blank. It was just like deep move, right? And I turned around and I just, for a minute, it was just like what happened to me in the kitchen just now. It was like, where am I? This is weird, you know. But there was something about it that just gripped me. Now, I have to tell you that we have a couple new people here, and the performance has just been wonderful. You know, to see people sit like this is deeply impressive to me, and I'm frankly envious, because during my first Sesshin, I was in agony the whole time, and I remember going into Dokuzan, and I literally just felt like, I mean, in my mind, I can actually sort of see myself crawling into Dokuzan. You know, it's like crawling on my hands and knees over to the cushion, you know. And I just remember being in a lot of pain, and I don't know how I got through it. I just don't know. But when I left the place, and when it was over, there was something, I had such a good feeling about. It was just I don't know why, even to this day, but it just gripped me. I guess part of it was that even though I was in a lot of discomfort, I felt really intensely alive, this really intense feeling of being alive. And then, you know, I actually signed up for, amazing thing, I signed up for another Sesshin. And I remember in those days, in the Seattle Zen Center, we had a regular sitting at the house of a person whose Dharma name was Oshin. He had a cabinet making business. He was a successful cabinet maker, and he sort of donated his house, actually, to use as the Zendo. And so we would sit there morning and night often. I would often go. There was sitting morning and night. And I would often go morning and night. And basically, it was got a little weird because the Oshin at some point, he had donated his house for our use. He hadn't given it to us. But he sort of lost interest in Zen. And, you know, so then it was a little bit awkward because there were like 30 people coming to sit every morning, and he'd be coming downstairs with his new girlfriend, you know. And they'd sneak into the kitchen, you know. And there were a few awkward moments, you know, to say the least. And we eventually we got the message, we had to leave eventually, you know. And it was, you know, we had great camaraderie. One of the things I loved was, you know, coming to sit in the evening, and I loved sitting. You know, I had a lot of physical pain. It was never easy for me physically to sit, but there was something about it that I just loved. I I always had a lot of trouble with my right leg. You know, the way I sit is I cross my, I take my left leg and put it on my right thigh, and then I take my right leg and right foot and put it on my left thigh. And for years, that was very difficult for me. And for some reason, my leg, my foot, my right foot would start to vibrate, right? It would just start bouncing around after a while. And it would start slipping off, right? So, you know, I'd get into, when I started doing full lotus, I would get into full lotus and then my foot would start bouncing around and it would start slipping off my, so that I was always trying to hold it up with the muscles in my leg, you know, and try not to move. In fact, at one time, this very famous meditation teacher named Hirano Katsufumi Osho, who was head of training at Eiheiji, major Soto temple in Japan, visited our group and led a sesshin. While Genki was away in Japan, I couldn't stop my leg from vibrating. In a classical Zen temple, you're not supposed to move even a muscle, right? Basically, if you move, there's a guy who will yell at you and hit you with a stick. Hirano-san played that role at the sesshin. So he would sit up at the front, facing all of us. His cushion was actually not like ours, it's facing. He would sit in front of the altar and surveying everybody, right? And just knowing he was watching me made me very nervous. You know? So I'd be sitting there and I thought, foot, you know, just be quiet, you know, don't move, please, you know. And my foot would start slipping, and then it would start wobbling, right, bobbing up and down. And then, of course, you know, he would see this, and he would go, "No moving!" And he'd come over, you know, yeah, what is wrong with you? For some reason, I never liked that guy. I don't know what it was. But actually, everything he did irritated me. The way he did Taisho, everything. I don't know why I stuck it out, but even though that was like the sesshin from hell, even though that was the session from hell, I just didn't want to stop doing this. I felt so alive. And the next session I did with Genki Roshi again, and it was just like heaven. Because he was such a kind person, and he didn't hit me with a stick when I couldn't make my leg stop moving. And also, my posture has never been that good, and Hirano-san would also hit me if my back wasn't straight. And so I would start out with a straight back, but I had this problem with my leg slipping off my... So in order to keep my leg, my foot on my thigh, I had to lean forward, right? And then that created pressure on my hip. So I would lean forward even more to take the pain off of my hip. So I would sort of be really craned forward, right? And then he would yell at me and push me back upright. And it would be like, you know, I could feel all the muscles tearing out of the socket, you know, as he pulled me back. And then my leg would start bobbing around and then he'd hit me with the stick, you know. So, you know, Genki was so kind and much more laid back about these matters. He figured that if I just kept sitting, my posture would improve. Or not, you know. And interestingly, it did improve quite a bit. My foot doesn't bob anymore. 30 years later, that problem seems to have gone away. And my posture's gotten a little better. I think Genki made the right decision, sort of a natural unfolding. Many years ago, the Dalai Lama came to our temple with an entourage of Tibetans. And actually, some of the Tibetans were in the community in Seattle. And Webb Sensei knew some of these Tibetans and had invited them to come and sit with us. So we would have a Thursday night sit, like our Thursday night sit. And basically the Tibetans showed up and they would sit with us sometimes. And their posture was very poor by Zen standards. They would sort of arrange themselves on the cushion any old way. They looked like bags of laundry, you know. They looked like red bags of laundry. And they weren't nice and straight, and they just, you know, they were hunched over, and their heads were down a little bit. And I do think posture is good. I think it is important to pay attention to posture. But, you know, the interesting thing was these guys would sit down, and they would enter samadhi, and they wouldn't move a muscle forever, you know. And so it really was instructive to me. It's like, oh, that's interesting, you know. So I think Genki's way was a wise decision. You know, you try to straighten your back, you know. You'll work it out. And actually, you sort of work it out without working it out in your head. You just work it out. Why did my leg stop bouncing around on my thigh? I don't know. Somehow it just worked itself out. A lot of Zen practice is like this. It's not conscious. You don't have to figure it out. The natural self, the natural true nature begins to manifest itself if you just have a kind of patience, a sort of patience, wise patience. Somehow I got over all my obstacles just by hanging in there and letting, we have this saying in English, which is a beautiful saying, letting nature take its course. You know, letting nature take its course. This practice is about letting nature take its course. And the way to let nature take its course, actually, is not to worry too much about consequences, but to be in deep mushing, be in deep mushing. Somehow that's why I stayed with Zen. You know, I went to these sesshin, and I had a lot of problems, a lot of obstacles. I won't bore you with all my problems in sitting. They're just physical problems. When I first started out, I had searing pain in my right knee. By day two, I would have all of these extra cushions under one of my knees. After a while, that just worked itself out. And then I began to have a dull aching pain in my left knee. And this went on for a few years. I'm not trying to discourage you, but it could be a while. that went away, and I began to have pain in my hip. And it would be quite interesting. It would be like, oh my God, what is that pain? I couldn't even find it, but it was my hip would be killing. And maybe 10 years ago, I began to have a lot of back pain. Now, when I sit, I very rarely have any back pain. In fact, generally, I feel wonderful. So somehow, there's always a new problem. Tomorrow it'll be something else, right? Your body and the whole of life has a kind of wisdom that we don't usually trust enough. But if we do trust it, it will begin to resolve our issues for us. This is really true. This is really so important. So important. I really know what it's like to be blocked, you know, in Zen practice. I was working on the breath perception koan for 5 years. Most of the people in this room finished with breath perception in a year or less, or maybe 2 years, depending. And in our group, it was pretty much the same thing. But I was I came into the Zen group around the same time most of the original members of the Seattle Zen group arrived. We all arrived at about the same time Genki Roshi came, and all of these people made so much progress on their koan. And I was just stuck for years and years with like what I thought was the most elementary koan, right? And it bothered me because I thought, this is just the breath. I want a real koan, and I couldn't let nature take its course. And sometimes we have deep karmic obstacles that we have to work through. Some of us are sort of compulsive control freaks, right? This is the way some people are. So we're always trying to get control of the situation. And so one of the things we just will eventually experience in Sesshin is a loss of control. You know, at some point, you don't have enough strength to try to control things anymore, right? And some of us have deeper obstacles that are very difficult to overcome, and we might never be able to access them consciously. But I hope you'll hear me when I say that there is no obstacle that can't be overcome by practicing Mu, by practicing Mu. So, this is about a great master who was a contemporary of Rinzai, Bokushu. Bokushu asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk gave a katsu shot. Now, in Chinese Zen, it was traditional to give there was a tradition of shouting. So this was just part of what Zen people did. It was considered an acceptable response. And it's been translated in Japanese as katsu. Bokushu asked a monk who has just arrived. Remember earlier I mentioned that at one time it was possible for monks and nuns to travel all over China and go to different temples and introduce themselves and practice there. So this is a monk who's traveled to Bokushu's temple, and Bokushu says, "Where are you from?" Now that's a Dharma question. He's trying to gauge the level of the student's mind. So a person who is not very far advanced would say, "I'm from New York City. I know I'm from Suzhou." And that would mean I'm still caught up in sort of everyday conventional ways of thinking about things. So the monk doesn't say that. Bokushu asked the monk, "Where are you from?" And he goes, "Katsu!" Gives a Zen shout. So he acts spontaneously, right? Somehow immediately acts without hesitation. "Where are you from?" "Katsu!" Now, that's a very advanced practitioner, somebody who can act spontaneously. And a lot of Zen practice is about learning how to have that kind of deep access to your true nature quickly. So when we do Zen practice, if we're working on the Mu koan, we are, it's like going up to a blank wall and sitting there. If you're working on the Mu koan, you know what I mean. It's like facing a blank wall. And indeed, this is the wall, the real wall that Bodhidharma faced in China was not the wall of a cave. It was the wall of that blankness you face when you're doing Mu. Okay? So you sit on the cushion, you work with your hara, you call Mu, and at the end of your breath, as you go, if you look at your mind, you will see that there's a kind of blankness or emptiness. Okay? And that seems trivial at first, but believe me, it takes great mental control to notice it at all, and also it's extremely important. That is the door of the Buddha. That's the door of the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas. Everything in Zen practice comes through that door. The collection of koans that we often use, the gate of no barrier, the U Men Kwan, the Mu Mong Khan, is referring to that blankness. Okay. So if you've been practicing for a while, being able to notice that blankness takes extraordinary mental control. And if you're frustrated with your practice right now, please don't be, because if you can encounter that blankness, that's wonderful and very difficult. You know, it's very hard to focus the mind on one point. So when you're doing breath meditation, you're focusing the mind on one point, and you're collapsing the separation between yourself and the object of your attention, which is artificial anyway. So when you regain your original unity with your breath, it's time to go to the Mu koan. And the Mu koan is tougher than the breath koan even, because now we're saying don't focus on any object, but follow your attention to the place where it encounters this emptiness. Okay? And then hold your mind in that emptiness. This is Mu practice. So Mu has very little to do with coming into the Zendo and letting out a powerhouse scream. Right? At many temples, there's a kind of competitive, it's like who's got the loudest Mu. You know, this is a fundamental misunderstanding. Mu practice is about being open to that emptiness, allowing yourself to be possessed by that emptiness. And it's very much like you've heard of demonic possession. Well, this is divine possession. Okay, this is allowing your true nature to, you could say, take possession of your body. And now you may all be a little frustrated. You might be saying, well, take possession! I'm waiting, you know, please! And it hasn't happened yet. And that can be frustrating, I understand. So, you sit on the cushion, you straighten your back, you breathe with the hara, you call Mu, and at the end of your breath, there's that blankness. Next time, same thing. Next time, same thing. Now, that's day two, right? Day three, blankness. 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 Day four, blankness. Okay? Now, this is the essence of Mu practice. You can get angry. You can say, well, I want to be possessed, but nothing's happening. Or you can be frustrated, or you can be disappointed. And please understand, any response that you have is just your karma talking. It's not real. But the point is, you can't make it happen. You can't make it happen. You know, I once went in to see Genki Roshi in Dokusan when I was working with the Mu koan, and I had already spent 5 years on the breath koan. And I thought, if breath took me 5 years, I'll be an old man before I get through this thing. And I went to talk to him, and I said, you know, I'm banging my head against this wall. And he was, again, so kind. He said, look, He said, you can't make the door open. You can't break the door down. All you can do is knock at the door and then patiently wait. Patiently wait. Now, if you don't knock, nothing is going to happen. So please don't misunderstand. I'm not saying be totally laid back. You know, this is the laid back group here. You know, I'm not saying that. I'm saying there's a kind of a patience, attentive patience, right, which is the proper mood for once you're facing that blankness, attentive patience. You can't break the door down, but you have to keep knocking. And you're just going to keep coming up to that door, or that wall, if you want to think about it that way. And each time you can possibly do it, you want to just keep coming back to that wall, back to that wall. And you don't necessarily appreciate it, but it's pure, deeply purifying to face that wall. Deeply purifying. You know, if you ever get frustrated with your life in any way, just sit down on the cushion, and even if you've been practicing Zen for 20 years, just sit down and face Mu for a while. And all your anger, all your fear, sooner or later, all your obstacles will melt away. They absolutely will. So facing this this barrier, this gate of no barrier, is a deeply purifying in itself. Now, angry people become less angry, fearful people become less fearful, hate people who have made a habit out of hate become more compassionate, envious people become more kindly and considerate of others and more less selfish. So this is a really important experience, but you just need to sit there and wait. And then one day, the doors are going to open and your true nature is going to come out and possess your body, right? That's really going to happen. And when that day comes, it's like two halves of yourself are reunited. It's a really wonderful, wonderful moment. You'll probably know it. You'll probably know. But you probably won't be conscious of the implications. And the more you think about this, the more you try to figure it out, the more you try to make a system out of it, the farther astray you're going to wander. So it's very important to try to have that blank mind all the time, as often as you can during the day. And if you're working on your koan too, if you're working on other koans also, such as what's the sound of one hand clapping, hot water, cold water, and so on, the more time you spend in that blankness, the better. And the less time you spend worrying, obsessing, thinking, trying to work through the issue intellectually, the better off you'll be. And so this patience is highly underrated, in my opinion. But it's everything really good requires patience. You know, I was at a session with Genki Roshi, and I was so frustrated. I was having trouble answering a later koan. And other people were, the frustration level was so high, you could, you know, it was like you could cut it with a knife. We were also bitterly disappointed that we weren't answering our koans. And Genki Roshi came out of the Dokusan room and he sat down and he could sort of sense the disappointment. And he said, well, he actually said aloud, he said, well, if you get nothing else out of Zen, at least you'll learn patience. And we all burst into laughter. We thought he was making a joke. And later, a few years later, when I remembered, I was so ashamed. I think my face actually turned red. I was just so ashamed. I said, did I really laugh at that? Oh my God. Because it's so important. It's your relationship to everything around you. You know, patience, the Buddha is patient. Isn't that interesting? I mean, people who are deeply awake are patient. Human ignorance, fearfulness, anger, envy, hatred, lust, these are infinite, right? Infinite. And it's like a bunch of crazy monkeys, right? And, the Buddha just comes along and says, well, let's start with the breath. Let's start with ethical conduct. Let's try to be a decent human beings. And then when we're not killing each other, we can try to work on our minds a little bit. And then, it's step by step by step. Greed, anger, and delusion, not just among humans, but in the universe itself, are said to be beginningless and endless. So bodhisattvas, enlightened beings who try to help, know that there's not going to be a resolution in their lifetime or in any lifetime. But this process goes on forever and ever and ever. See? And there's no Armageddon. It just goes on eternally in all directions. See? So patience, very important for bodhisattvas and Buddhas. Because infinite ignorance. So if you get discouraged about your own situation, please don't be. Because it's not, ignorance is not infinite. And, anger is not infinite. Very shallow, as a matter of fact. But this patience is so important. So I can't praise it highly enough. This is also part of being an empty-headed fool. Now, by now, I guess you've noticed that the empty-headed fool is a praise in this koan. Right? I mean, basically, you empty-headed fool is basically bestowing high praise on the monk. So we don't know when the teacher and the monk have this exchange whether the teacher has stumped the student or the student is holding his own. He comes from another temple, and he says, Bokushu says, where do you come from? He goes, Khats! And then Bokushu says, all right, well, fine. What would you say after you said Khats two more times? After you said Katsu, Katsu. What answer would you give then? See? And the monk's silent. And we can't know intellectually if that silence was because he's stumped, or if that's what he is doing because those are the instructions he's getting from his true nature. And then the master says, oh, empty-headed fool, great praise. So this is somebody who's lived the life of facing emptiness and developed beginningless and endless patience, right? Inexhaustible patience, and has been knocking at the door forever and ever, right? And it keeps knocking. And every knock is a fresh knock. Every knock is like a saying yes. You say, do you want to practice Zen? Yes. So my patience. Wait, do you want to practice Zen? Yes! Yes! See, and every knock should be like that. It should be yes! Yes! See, because look, here's another way to look at it. Let's say you come to maybe another couple of years of sitting, and then you have Daikensho. Okay? Great. And then, after your Daikensho, it's going to be wonderful. Right? Everything is revealed, etc., etc. Okay. Not quite like that, as a matter of fact, but let's just say it. Because there's always more to learn. See, everything is never revealed. There's always more to learn. But let's say you have Daikensho and everything is revealed. Okay. Then you die. Okay. Then you come back. And guess where you are? You're right back on the same goddamn cushion again. See? And then you have Kensho, and then you die, and then you're, guess where you are? You're right back on the cushion again. So you might as well enjoy it, might as well enjoy it. It's a wonderful place. This ignorance of ours is so wonderful. It's so wonderful not to have answered my call on today. See? And it's not going to stop me from trying, not even in the least. See? Because, I mean, everybody has koan forever and ever and ever. See, a universe is constantly unfolding in all directions. Infinite amount to know. Infinite amount to experience. So I have my koans too, all the time. Everybody. Dalai Lama has his koans too. So we're all on the cushion sweating bullets, right? And we have a choice. We have a number of choices. We can say, well, I'll do it, but, you know, that's a sort of like, I don't want to invest too much of my emotional capital in this. Right? We can get pissed off or, you know, you can say, whatever happens is Buddha. Now I'm going to give it my best effort, breath by breath, even if I never am. If you can say that and you can mean it, that is Buddha. That is enlightenment. If you can say, I'm going to do it no matter what the outcome, no matter what, that is the purest practice. That's the purest practice. That's heaven itself, right? It's just being grateful for the moment, being grateful for the opportunity to learn and to practice. That's heaven itself, I think. So please, this is day three of the session. You know, I am so glad you're here. It's so precious. And this session is going to be over in no time. It's going to be over in no time. This is a precious opportunity to walk this beautiful path. Here it is, and it's we're right at the center of the session. So please be an empty-headed fool. You know, all day long, when you're not thinking about your koan, you know, remember empty-headed fool, empty-headed fool, empty-headed. That's who you want to be. And the empty-headed fool is your true nature. Seen through the eyes of your discriminating mind. See, the little mind looks at big mind and says, a stupid, empty head. But that's a little mind's perspective, little mind's word for it. The big mind is the wisdom of the universe. So with your little mind, you can say, empty-headed fool, empty-headed fool. But be an empty-headed fool today. And then everything is going to be wonderful, really and truly, absolutely.